This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. Christine Berlend has taken readers on a journey. It's to a small town in northern Italy that has always been a wool manufacturing area. We also go back in time to 1750s when local councils had more say. A single witness is not a political story as much as a story of a young, vulnerable girl. Christine Berlend, welcome back.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So this Council of Ten, what decisions could they make?
So they were responsible for the laws, so they were the political system, but also the legal system in Venice prior to the French invasion in 1797, so when it was the Venetian Republic. They were a law unto themselves. The Council of Ten was made up of aristocratic men, some of them quite elderly. The Doge was the head of the Council of Ten.
And they could choose whether somebody, whether it was a new person coming to the town or somebody who's lived there all their life, to be a citizen and given the power and being looked after as a citizen.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was also a local council in the sort of town, the town that I've written about. So there was a sort of separate, slightly separate kind of, like we would have a local council as opposed to the kind of Supreme Court and the, you know, the state government.
When Anna Marie Bonon was 11, what did the Council of Ten allow her to do?
So there wasn't the same sense of childhood that we have today. As a member of a farming family, she was already out working at the age of 11, and she worked at the local woolen mill, and she raised silkworms at night at home to bring in extra income.
So at 11 she was allowed to work.
Yes.
The book begins with Anna Maria at 13 years old, and this is a quote. "In her mind's eye, the priest's face appears unbidden. He is bent with rage. Tell them you lied," he says. What is it that Anna Maria wants to report to the council?
So Anna Maria was abused by her father, and she was extremely brave, and she spoke out, and this case went very far, as you know, having read it, into the court system. But pressure was applied to her to deny her story after she had spoken it.
Now, I didn't know who her rapist was, so every time I was reading this, I would read about a man and I'd think, is it him? Is it him? Oh. So her first friend, Barto, she's known for 5 years, but he's doing something now too as a young boy.
Yes. Obviously, there's class differences, but also gender differences in terms of how the expectations and the what was allowed. Barto, well, he's an only child. I mean, sadly, because his siblings have passed away, but his parents do have enough income available to be able to educate him. So he has lessons with the priest, and he learns to read. Whereas Anna Maria is illiterate, certainly in the beginning of the novel, though. I'm hoping
the priest, Father Antonio, he lives comfortably, and what power does he have over the congregants?
So the Council of Ten were physically fairly far away at this point. So this village is now a few hours from Venice by sort of, you know, train or car, but back
a
in
long
the day,
way by foot.
By foot, it was many days' walk. So, and there, you know, it wasn't very large. That, you know, 10 people. There were not police really in the villages or anything like that. And so the priests had a kind of, you know, they did have that sort of role in the community of making sure that, I guess, there was peace on the streets and people were behaving.
He could pull people in to go to church and be very, you know, sort of questioning if they didn't come to church.
Yes. Well, he did have a lot of power ultimately.
At the mill where Anna Maria cards wool, there is Zapatti, the owner, brought in to manage over a local man, Biancan. In what way is Biancan connected to Anna Maria's family?
So Biancan, he's the manager, and he does sort of take care of the women who are working at the mill, but he's also the godfather of Anna Maria's father. which, well, from a novelist's point of view, that made him quite an interesting character, I guess, in terms of a sense of responsibility. Giacomo, and I imagine we'll get onto him shortly, but Giacomo didn't have a present father, so his father was absent, which in that kind of time would have put more responsibility, I think, on the godfather figure who was around.
So Giacomo's the father, Anna Marie's the daughter, and there's a grandmother. Now, grandmother could have married Biancan and chose a less suitable person. She did ask him to be her son's godfather, but it's a difficult relationship because Giacomo is difficult. In what That's way? Right.
Well, I mean, as you've already insinuated, I mean, he does molest his daughter. He's an alcoholic. He's an itinerant farm worker, but he doesn't really bring in very much income for the family. And he makes trouble. He gets into fights at the pub and that sort of thing. He has a bad reputation.
Oh, terrible. Mm. We know that Anna Marie's mother has died and also a little sister. But now there's an eviction order. Why are they being evicted from their house?
So very small community houses, very close together. So all the neighbours had a pretty good sense of what was going on. They could hear outbursts and, you know, they saw that Anna Marie's grandmother was sometimes sent out at night from the house and not allowed back in. So she had to find somewhere to sleep. Yeah, he was disrupting the peace in the village, basically. So the neighbours were complaining and the priest were kind of... He was with the neighbours and he also, I think, would preferred for Giacomo to be out of the village.
Well, the neighbours complained to Father Antonio, but he says there's a difference between gossip and confession. So we're going to hear a little bit about a discussion because the priest brings in Anna Maria.
So Father Antonio asks, "How does your father treat you?" She folds her fingers into a steeple. Is he kind? Sometimes. And when he's not kind, what does he do? Does he give you trouble? She nods. What kind of trouble? When he drinks, sometimes he hits me. Does he do anything else? I didn't understand what he wanted. He made me do things I didn't want to do. She struggles for air. He must hear her. She pushes the words out. He forces himself on me. He sighs, leaning forward in his chair. Are you aware, child, that this is a grave sin? He pauses, waiting for her to look up. The cup is hard and shiny, made from clay, drawn from the earth. Anna Maria, what is a mortal sin? Her mouth twitches. She stares at her hands and pushes out the words. It is a grave sin that takes away God's grace. Indeed, listen to me carefully. Anna Maria, violenza carnale, brutalizzazione, rape, is a mortal sin. It is dangerous. There may be consequences, shame and eternal damnation. You must stop him. You must not let him touch you. He pauses, peering at the bookshelf along the wall. She is shaking, the heat again in her legs, her pounding heart. Is he saying that the sin is hers? But how? How can I stop him?
It's just terrible to think that she takes the blame, absolutely. And when Anna Maria tells her grandmother about her rape, this is another quote. For shame! My grandmother grabs Anna Maria's arm and shakes her. Her eyes gleam in fury. You are a disgusting child to imagine such a thing. I am ashamed of you. Oh. Anna Maria is taken from work and disappears. Biancan from the mill reports her missing to Father Antonio. How does the priest see what's happening to her to be a problem for himself?
So I think in the beginning he did have a little bit of a sense that he should be trying to do something about this and stop it. But his way of going about that was, as you've said, to really, to put the responsibility on her shoulders, which was obviously inappropriate and ineffectual. So I think that priest really, I think he had his own self-interest at heart. And he wanted to hold on to his position in the community. He had a large house. He had a housekeeper.
He had a good life.
He had a pretty good life. He didn't want to rock the boat there. And he had a sense, there was a sense that Giacomo had friends. You know, it was pretty unlikely that Giacomo would be convicted, but he would know that the priest was against him, and then his friends would come and perhaps burn down the village or burn down his house or something. So I think he was frightened ultimately.
Giacomo is arrested on something completely different, and they have to go to the prison as grandmother wants to get him released. Of course, Anna Maria doesn't want him released, but a grandmother's words. Now let's listen here this about the grandmother's words from page 221.
"You can't do this," Nonna continues, her soft voice firm. "Things happen to women, but they don't talk about it. Things might be unpleasant or inconvenient, but a woman puts up with them. Who do you think you are, talking to the justice about such things? What will they think of us? We are respectable people. We go to church every Sunday. You must tell them it's not true, Anna Maria. Go back to Vicenza. Tell them that you were lying."
This book is not all about the physical horror or the inability of women to help other women. You get back into a convent, and this is where you and I had another chat about your award-winning novella, about the possible life choices for a female violinist in 18th century Venice. That book was water music. And is that where you found this story? Because this story is based on truth.
Oh, I did find this story while I was researching that one, but I found it in a book in the library as I was just doing extra research. So I didn't find it directly during that process. But
It's written so beautifully. You've sort of sent the tone for this so well. And then we have the Venetian Proverbs. And the first one, it takes seven women to make a single witness. Oh.
Well, I think I could not believe it when I found that proverb, because it just highlighted to me what an extraordinary young woman Anna Maria was at 13, given that that was how women were seen, that their word was not trusted, but that she had the strength and courage to speak out at that time was amazing.
Anna Maria feels most free with nature, and she has silkworms, and each chapter has a profound fact in the storytelling that also links to the life of the silkworm, such as when we find out about her dead sister, there's Vacca, a silkworm that dies before making a cocoon. Then there's Getty, a disease that affects young silkworms, make them look like caterpillars of another large moth. And of course, this is where the grandmother, reflecting on the beautiful baby that Giacomo was and the horrible man he grew to be. This was really very clever.
Thank you. Yes, that was a happy research accident that came about.
Well, that's what happens. Women proving rape is questionable in court today, but what of a 13-year-old in Vicenza, Italy, back in 1757. Christine Berlant has written another wonderful historical fiction, written from a well-researched fact in a single witness. Thank you very much, Christine.
Thank you, Jen.
Well, we're back in the Highlands of Scotland in Laura McCluskey's latest novel, The Cursed Road. So, Laura, welcome back to 3CR.
Thank you so much. I think the thing I was most excited for was to hear this accent again. It was so good last time.
Me showing off, I apologise.
No, it's great.
Now, while this novel is a standalone read with a murder and an old missing persons investigation, the central characters have returned bearing the brunt of the trauma they faced in the previous novel you wrote, The Wolf Tree. Can you briefly go into what happened to Detective Inspectors Georgina Lennox and Richard Stewart on Eileen Erdar in The Wolf Tree, and how does it influence the dynamic in this novel?
Yeah, so when we first meet George and Richie, it is on this case where they're being sent off to this far-flung island off the west coast of Scotland to investigate the death of a teenager. And within the first few pages, it becomes very clear that George is hiding a secret from Richie. And we find out pretty quickly that it is she was involved in a workplace incident where she was quite injured. And so she's now relying on painkillers and sleeping tablets to get her through the day. And it's a secret that we get the feeling that Richie knows. He knows that something's going on. He wants to find out what it is, and she just keeps throwing up walls. And so by the time that secret is revealed, it's caused quite a fracture in their friendship. So now when we pick up in The Cursed Road, 10 months have passed, and so that fracture has deepened.
But it's almost flipped.
And it has, the dynamic has flipped because of everything that they went through in that first book on the island, where they uncovered this centuries-old secret that the islanders were performing. The nature of the things that happened to them, the trauma they experienced, it's now become a dynamic where George was once the icy, kind of prickly one, and Richie was the ray of sunshine. And now she's suddenly the more stable, almost friendly one, and he's the one who's going through some damage.
And she's been asked to spy on him.
Well, that's right. Basically. He's now gotten himself into a bit of hot water at work, whereas once upon a time he was reliable, friendly, you know, beloved by his colleagues. Suddenly he's really lashing out at people and he's causing concerns, and so their boss has assigned George the task of watching him.
And that influences the investigation over the course of the novel. Now, there's been a gruesome discovery of a young murdered woman, but her body reveals a link to a 10-year-old missing persons case. How is it gruesome? What's so gruesome about this body?
Well, it was actually the first flash of an image that I had when I was cooking up this book, was the idea of this young woman's body found on the side of a remote road with a name that had been carved into her bare arm. And I knew that this name was going to be really important, and I knew it was going to have a personal connection. And so we find out that the name that has been carved into her arm connects to a cold case that Richie thought that he would never be able to solve. He assumed that he would retire and it would be the case that retired with him.
So this is basically the two strands in some ways running through the novel. Mm-hmm. Now, the body of the missing person is a journalist's delight because we're in Scotland, it's hunting season. A dead body, unnamed, is called?
Well, in everywhere except Scotland, a Jane Doe, but this journalist takes great delight in the fact that this young woman was murdered from what we suspect is a bullet caliber that's used in deer hunting, and this woman is unnamed, therefore he delights in calling her Jane Doe. And he also calls her Bambi.
Oh, geez.
So basically, the demeaning, really, of an individual in that regard. But of course, you know, journalists need to create a sort of atmosphere mm-hmm. about it. But this brings us to Henry Shaw. I can make you a victim. I can make you a saint. The role of journalists, the connection between Henry Shaw and Georgina Lennox. What's going on there?
Yes, well, it's very tense between the two of them. Henry is an up-and-coming journalist in Scotland. He's creating quite a name for himself. And unfortunately, he's very good at his job. And so when we first meet Henry, it's clear that he's been on the trail of the story of Georgina Lennox for the past 10 months, ever since the events of the Wolf Tree. He really wants that story about what happened on the island. And for the reasons I outlined, George is very reluctant to talk about what happened on that island. So it's a very tense, prickly relationship, but as we see when we read the book, it develops into something interesting.
There's a transition mm-hmm. there as well, but initially it verges on harassment.
Oh, very much so. She says that she's going to arrest him for stalking, and he kind of laughs it off and says, "I thought we were good friends."
But now we get to the setting. And here we go with the Gaelic again. You've had a Gaelic term in the previous novel, and let's hope I can get this right, Anradamincha.
Oh, perfect. Well done.
But what is it?
That is The Cursed Road.
But it's also got a couple of other names as well.
Yes, well, Damansha can be translated as cursed. It can be translated as damned. There's a few different iterations of how you can take it, but all of them apply to this scenario.
Well, this actually takes us then into the realm of folklore, the mysterious and the macabre, which is, again, that connection with the Wolf Tree, picking up on that trope again. And we've got an ancient story. In America, it would have been called the Hatfields and McCoys. What's gone on between the Fairgreaves and the Grants?
So the Hatfields and the McCoys was one of my biggest inspirations. But to bring it across to Scotland as well, I was really inspired by the story of the Glencoe Massacre. So that occurred in 1692, and it was between these two warring clans, the Campbells and the Macdonalds. There was this institution in Highland Scotland called Highland Hospitality. So if your worst enemy came to your door and said, "I will lay down my arms in exchange for food and for care and for shelter," you had to welcome them inside inside your doors as long as neither of you rose arms against each other. However, what happened is the Campbells received a message that said you must turn on the McDonald's, and they did, and they slaughtered 30 people in the middle of the night in their beds. And then a further, they say 10 to 20 people died as they tried to escape out into this brutal Scottish winter. And the ramifications of that, the betrayal has rippled throughout time to the point where there are apparently still some pubs in rural areas of Scotland that have signs up on the wall that say, "We will not serve Campbells." So I was really interested about what it would look like to take this story of these feuding families, the Fairgreaves and the Grants, who were brought together to potentially solve their issues with a marriage that has gone awry, and what that looks like if a betrayal occurred that has rippled throughout time, and how this modern town, this little village, would still hold on to that.
So it still resonates in this setting of the moors and the forests and such like. But what's going on the old Grant estate? It's changed hands.
Yes, it has. It's been taken over by this luxury hunting lodge. So I've established that there are these this couple, this Francina and Patrick, and they have hunting lodges all over the world. She's from South Africa, and she's got quite a reputation as a hunter herself. And we find out that she's actually had plenty of run-ins with these local animal activists who swear up and down that this hunting lodge is doing the wrong thing. And so she's already got it in. George understands that Francina is already against people coming onto her land, and that she'll protect her reputation at any cost.
So what's the connection with the missing body here? How much can you tell us?
Oh, I'm not sure. It's very, very curious that this young woman's body has been found on the side of the road that borders on this hunting lodge. And there are indications about her that suggest that there's a connection to maybe these animal activists.
But also there's another thread coming through. We've got Rab Brown, who works on this estate, but his former name was Robert McAllister.
That's right.
And what has he been known for?
Well, Robert McAllister, up until a few months prior to the story, has been in prison for attacking a young woman who fits the exact same demographic as this young woman who's been found on the side of the road, and another woman who's gone missing. So he's a very interesting character indeed.
So we've got missing girls, we've got a dead body, we've got a 10-year-old case, but also then you ratchet things up and things become quite gothic. Now, there's only so far we can take this, but for example, are they cursed? I think I'm cursed. Do you remember back on Erda? I remember everything about Erda. Then you remember that someone placed an honest-to-God back luck charm on us, and I absolutely thought it was rubbish at the time, but I'm scared that it might have actually worked, that I'm actually cursed. Mm. Now, this is Georgina Lennox. What's going on here?
I know. For a woman who I established as, you know, one who saw things in black and white, she very quickly does believe that this curse that was planted on them, on Adar, has worked. She's, like I said, 10 months have passed, and in that 10 months, things haven't been going all too great for her. And so now they're out in this place where they're researching, they're investigating a case that takes place on a cursed road. A lot of things are lining up very uncomfortably for her.
But it also picks up on the victim psychology. I'm responsible for being the victim. So you've woven that in here.
Yeah, and I found that really interesting listening to Christine just now, hearing that how much that story resonates with you as well. And it just goes to show that no matter where you place it in time or across the world, women are always going to adopt that sense of guilt and blame and ownership first. It was definitely something I wanted to discuss in the book, the fact that these women who, through no fault of their own, are placed in these circumstances where it's they have to make a terrible decision with the options that they have, and how they take that blame onto themselves.
But you've also picked up on some statistics here. There were something like, 77 missing person cases active at the moment. So that's on one day.
At the time of writing,
So you looked into that data.
Yeah, absolutely. I was scouring Scottish missing persons websites to find their data, and across the UK as a whole. And I think, as I say in the book, they list their active cases. But then once there hasn't been a lead or any indication of where this person might be after about a year, they get shifted into a long-term missing category, and that's where they almost become cold cases.
cold cases, but also then an echo of victimhood, or I don't know how you'd describe it, that folklore that permeates the landscape.
Exactly. I mean, Scotland is so... The atmosphere in Scotland, the air is full of all of these ancient stories of betrayals and feuds and deaths and missing people. So to be able to talk about it in the book, I felt like it was really important to talk about the statistics and to talk about the injustices involved as well.
But you take it then to another level. You get to the truly gothic, and this is where we actually discover the connection between the missing case and the current body and everything, and tie it in with the long-term folklore and history. Now, we can't give too much away.
I know. I'd love to.
Well, what's so gothic about it? Crypts, rusted keys, iron gates, castles and parapets and all. So you've really gone to town.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a really big fan of Gothic literature and Gothic films. So any opportunity that I can take to weave those into my stories, I leap at.
But how close to the truth can some of this be?
I mean, you would be surprised. Because I obviously am based here in Melbourne and I'm writing stories that are set in Scotland, I research everything down to the finest detail to make sure that not only am I obviously having fun with the Gothic tropes and to weaving in all these entertaining elements of the story, I want them to be based in reality so that a Scottish person could pick up this book and say, yeah, you know what, I actually do live down the road from a castle, because that is very much the case for a lot of people.
Yeah, and the history, the imagination that goes on behind it. Well, Laura McCluskey has a penchant for the Scottish Highlands, for the folk tales embedded in the landscape, and for that arc of emotional recovery that characters can experience. And let's not forget a good old murder investigation to boot in the latest novel, The Cursed Road, and it's a HarperCollins release. So, Laura, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Aren't we really lucky as readers to have such authors who research and give us a sense of being somewhere else?
Well, when were you last in Scotland, Laura?
I was there in 2023 researching for this book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so did a big road trip, discovered all the castles and spooky places.
And Christine, when were you last in Italy?
I did the research for this novel in 2018 and, it was...
I'm going to have to take up writing a book set in some way off exotic location.
Well, I have heard of authors deciding to set their books on cruise ships so that they could take a little tax deductible holiday. It's not a bad idea.
But a murder on a cruise ship, I think we've had that before.
It's been done. Yeah.
Thank you, authors. Thank you, David.
We are going. You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.